Think of Coca-Cola, and you get an instant visual image of its iconic contour bottle. A block of purple in the confectionery aisle can draw you to Cadbury. And I bet that if you see a red bottle thumbnail with a Keystone Jape label, you will recognize Heinz ketchup in less than a second. Each of these elements are distinctive brand assets. They are the aspects of a brand that form its identity. Built up over time and embedded in your memory, distinctive assets trigger the brand in the minds of buyers and help them identify the brand with ease online, in store, in the street, or on your phone. Packaging design should seduce, inform, and even save the planet. I'm Hernan Braverman, and this is Branderman, the podcast where I talk with experts to uncover what it actually takes to make a positive impact on consumers, the market, and society. Warning: keep this podcast out of the reach of close-minded marketers and designers. Before the interview, let me introduce my design agency.
Brands with purpose. Human, agile, honest brands that leave no one indifferent. Tridimage creates and revitalizes brands to imagine and shape the future. Tridimage, the branding and packaging design agency for bold brands.
Today, I had the pleasure to speak with Jenny Romanek, the international director of the world-famous Ehrenberg Bass Institute, based in Adelaide, Australia, and author of the books Building Distinctive Brand Assets and How Brands Grow, Part 2. Jenny is a leading expert in brand equity, mental availability, distinctive assets, and the role of loyalty and growth. In this episode, we discuss about how to future-proof a brand's identity. We talk about the importance of building bridges between the different touchpoints where a brand is present. She also told me what are the biggest mistakes brands make when they try to be distinct. With me today, Jenny Romanek. Jenny, each of us is a container of ideas, projects, and dreams. However, we can't read the label when we are inside the jar. What do you think your label says, or what would you like it to say?
I would like it to say that someone who has a curious mind and likes to solve problems.
When did you discover that?
I've always liked solving problems. I used to, as a child, pull things apart to see how they worked, try to put them back together, not always successfully, but I was always curious to know what was going on underneath the surface. And it ended up manifesting itself in marketing and branding.
Can you take us back to where it all began for you as a marketing researcher?
Well, I was one of those people, I accidentally came into marketing. So I actually started studying as an occupational therapist. And what I realized is while I was really interested in it, I didn't know I would be very good at it. Because one of the challenges with being an occupational therapist is you do have to accept the limitations that people have. And I realized I probably would get very frustrated with that. And so I started looking at alternatives, and one of the other people at the college was doing this thing called a business degree. I went, oh, that sounds sensible and practical. Maybe I'll do that instead. So I enrolled in a marketing degree. But I had no idea what I wanted to do as a marketer. I had no great ambition to be a particular type of marketer, work in a particular sector or anything. The only thing I remember thinking is, I never want to wake up and care about what dishwashing liquid people use. For some reason, that struck me as like not a very fulfilling life. And that's no disrespect to the people who are in that. It was just me as a naive 19, 20-year-old going, life has to be more than that. So I decided rather than make a commitment to a career, I would just go backpacking. And so I did the typical Australian thing and got, well, I had friends in the US, went and visited them, then got a working holiday visa for England. And so I just backpacked around for a couple of years. And then I got back and I went, all right, now I have to find a job because I've got no money because I spent it all traveling. And then there was an advertisement to do your master's by research in marketing. And I went, oh, that sounds interesting. and went and applied and got that, and that sort of got me on the path that I'm at. Note, it is the only time that the marketing department of the university has ever advertised for marketing research candidates. So I consider my career and where I am a few happy accidents that ended me up here.
What wisdom have you gained in the process of researching brands?
I've learned a lot about understanding the brain and understanding its wonders, but also its limitations, because I think we need to understand both in order to do marketing well, particularly branding well. And I think a lot of our strategy has a very idealized notion of our brains rather than the imperfect world that our memories create. And that's allowing for the fact we still don't know a lot about how our brain works. We're still learning so much. But even that bit of knowledge we have, I find, really factored into our branding activities, our advertising activities, anything where we're trying to inform or change people's brains. I find that there's a big disconnect between there. And I think the marketing research and marketing discipline is worse off for that disconnect.
Wow. And what inspired you to write a book about distinctive brand assets? What are they and why do they matter?
So I, a long time ago, did my PhD looking at basically how the stuff in people's heads influences the brands they buy. And I tested a range of different hypotheses for these, what we call brand perceptions, and discovered that it didn't matter so much what people had in their heads. What mattered was how much. So the quantity of knowledge that people had about a brand seemed to be more important for their future behavior than the substance of any individual piece of knowledge, which was very contrary to the whole idea of positioning, differentiation, et cetera. Now, as part of that, one of the things to build mental availability is you have to have really good branding, because the idea behind mental availability is you want a relevant message, which is something often other people can say, but you want to say it in a really individual way to you.
Can you explain mental availability?
Sure. Mental availability is this idea of just how do you get the brand easily thought of? So I liken mental availability as the sum of the sort of highways that people have in their minds. When you're traveling down a road and you want to get quickly to a destination, you usually take a highway because it's the quickest route to get to where you want to go. And so our brain does that with memories. Whenever we want something from a category, it takes us down the mental highways that's going to get us not exactly where we want to go, but close to it. So mental availability is about understanding those options and making the brand a salient part of that.
I love your travel analogies, the highway.
Transport now, not really travel. Yeah. Well, it just has to be enough to meet the needs of what you're looking for. Because that's the thing about highways. You don't take them for the travel, you take them for the destination. So mental availability is about understanding that a big chunk of effectiveness is about getting into the race. And so mental availability is how you get into the race to then hopefully be good enough on the day to be bought. So if you think about it, another analogy I often use, it's like qualifying for the Olympics. Even if you're the fastest runner in the world, you can't win a gold medal unless you do that first step of qualifying. So even if you're the best brand in the world, you can't get chosen if you're not thought of as an option first of all. So mental availability is about getting the brand thought of by more people in more buying situations.
Great. And what is the role of these distinctive brand assets in that scenario?
What it means is that you really want to make sure everything you put out there is unmistakably linked to your brand in people's memories. So to do that, you need good branding. And when we first started saying that, it seemed uncontentious. It seemed obvious. Of course, you need good branding. Until I started realizing that what I thought good branding was not what other people thought was good branding, because people would send me an ad that had no branding until the last 2 seconds. And yeah, it might have been strong for that last 2 seconds. And they'll go, hey, isn't this a great ad? Isn't the branding really strong? I'd be thinking, no, it's not, because all you've got it is, yes, that's a very powerful 2 seconds at the end of the ad, but if you don't have the branding early, what about all those people who aren't watching the last 2 seconds? You've lost them all. So we realized we need to have a conversation of what was good branding. And then as part of that conversation, introducing the idea that the brand is not just the name, it's everything else that could trigger the brand name. We settled on the name of distinctive assets, in that they're things that are different for the brand but are beneficial as a name to cover all of those non-brand name triggers of the brand name. And then that started building into, okay, well, if we have this idea, how do we measure it? And we realized also there were no metrics. And if you don't have any way of measuring or metrics, then how do you make smart decisions?
Our podcast is focused on package design. So I would like to know, what are some of the design lessons that you have learned over the years in marketing science? Especially, what do you think is the role of package in building a brand?
It is a really important role. And we actually have some research that I'm just going to tease about, because I can't talk about it yet, because it's not actually, I'm part of the team, but I'm not the lead researcher, that's actually looking specifically at pack changes. And we've been, over the last couple of years, learning a lot about those. Part of the lead into that research is, what we learned was that often packs are changed not for the benefit of either the consumer or the brand. They seem to be changed for other motivations. And a lot of them have to do with well-intended but ultimately destructive pack changes. I've also learned that there's a lot of things that go on packs where they potentially don't damage, but they distract. Hmm. And that by isolating what are we having as specifically as branding devices, what are we having specifically as messaging devices? So their purpose is to communicate. We're organic, we're GMO-free, we have lemons inside, or we're lemon-scented. So their purpose is to communicate something. Once you have those two bits of information sorted, anything else, you have to ask yourself, why is it there? And maybe it helps gain attention for the pack, but I find there's a lot of things when we assess packs that are images on pack that really don't have any solid purpose. I think they're more put there in hope rather than strategy. Yeah, so that's some of the things I've discovered, in particularly in the area of packaging research.
Speaking about change, one of your four commandments to future-proof a brand's identity is make know your default response to change. I have even heard, like you said before, you warned that changing the pack is practically never buyer-friendly. What is then for you the role of package designers when we are commissioned to update a leading brand?
Well, that's a good question. And that's part of the conversation, is why do you need to update the pack? What's the motivation behind that? And that's part of what will be challenging in the research that's coming up. But what I will say is, I mean, I do research that assesses proposed pack changes, and some of my best research from a corporate perspective has resulted in nothing happening. Yeah. And the thing is, you never see that research because nothing changed. But what happened is we averted something that was either just going to be costly for no benefit, or costly and damage the brand from happening. So I think we need to question why change happens. And I really put this to designers out there. I've had a lot of designers who've told me that basically, unless we keep the brand up to date, the sky will fall. But I haven't seen any evidence to support that. So I do put it out there to go, you know, if we can have some evidence base for that, I'd be quite happy to go, okay, then maybe we do need to.
But what about if you try to bring a new asset onto the pack? For example, create a proprietary structure when you have been using a standard bottle, or to make a distinctive asset more prominent, or try to remove some distracting material. Isn't that a good idea?
Oh, absolutely. But they're based on a strategy that's in evidence. I see a lot of times when people use the word update, often we're a bit bored with it. Can we update the font type of thing? Or, you know, the color looks a bit drab. Color assets in packaging is really rare as an asset, because in a lot of cases, colors have devolved into flavor or variant indicators. And so brands can't really own the color. I had a company come to me and they had heard in a focus group that their color was considered old-fashioned. And so there was a move to change it. And this was a brand that had been around for at least 50 years in the same color. And just based on a comment in a focus group, they were willing to throw that away. Luckily, they did the research where we could show them that not only was it a strong asset for them, it was one of the few color assets in that category. So they didn't end up changing it. But so that's the sort of update I'm railing against, not the update that is an evidence-based one where you're taking something off the pack. I talk about these things I call shopping assets, which are not, they're on pack, but they're more than that. They're things that have been built up in the minds of buyers as ways to find the pack. So this might be the shape, the color of the closure. It could be an image on the pack. It could be the logo. It can be a range of things that are used for shopping. And shopping assets are different from packaging assets because okay. They're not just on pack. They've usually been built up in advertising so that people's minds know what to look for. Oh, I look for the pink top. Oh, I look for this little character on pack or the purple flower, something like that. So they're the ones that you don't want to change themselves because you want to build up consistency in the form of that asset in people's minds. But you might alter the environment around them to make that stand out more. But what you've got to do is to be careful not to interrupt people's visual recognition systems.
That function of the package would be like a beacon on the shelf. So it's about renewing the painting, but not altering the beacon.
Yeah. So to do that, you first of all have to understand what can work as beacons and what you want to build as that beacon, because you might not have an asset that's very strong now, but the next year is going to be spent building it. So you want to keep it really consistent and prominent so that when you spend the time building it up in people's minds through advertising, it's then very easy for them to then see it on pack as well. Whenever you change visual recognition systems, you have to retrain their brain. So that's, again, where the stuff out of store comes into play to help any change you make in store.
What about meaning? Because we as designers are sometimes obsessed with meanings of shapes, colors, and that. Should we, for example, choose green to mean natural, or it would be better to choose a distinctive color that it's not related to the meaning that we are trying to achieve?
Yeah, we have to be very careful about assuming a uniform perception of meaning, and that even matters. So if you take color, for example, in different places, colors can mean different things to people. And so assuming that everyone who sees that color will like it and have the same opinion or thoughts evoked by it is often not backed up by evidence. But even if it is, if you choose a color, so this is the difference between something being a branding device and a messaging device. So if you choose green because you think it signals natural, then you're making it a messaging device. That element of the pack is telling people we're natural. That means it's not a branding device. So that's the only time we get into trouble is when we try to make something a messaging device and a branding device at the same time. Because what happens is the message interferes with retrieval of the brand.
Is it easy to recognize in a package what works as these shopping devices and which as a messaging device?
Well, sometimes it's the intent of the person who is putting it out there that you've chosen green because it has that meaning. My first step would always be to check that that meaning is a universal, consistent thought, because I find often that is not the case. But there have been some cases where it is. And in that case, you have to think about what's more important here, the meaning or the brand, because people will typically only think once. The other struggle you have when you have something with meaning, and funnily enough, this was actually a court case that included the color green. So someone else was using the color green and they wanted to go to court to say, no, green is our color. And the judge actually threw the case out because they said that green means natural, therefore it can't stand for the brand. So if you choose something that has meaning, other people can use that same asset for that same meaning. You can't actually own it as a distinctive asset. So that for longevity of an asset doesn't help. It also doesn't help because brands evolve over time. There might be something else that you want the brand to stand for in the future, in which case you're putting an expiry date on that asset. So there's a whole heap of reasons why it's really sensible to decouple branding devices from messaging devices that might have other meanings attached to them. And it's just about being able to own it and being able to keep it for a very long time.
Jenny's book, Building Distinctive Brand Assets, is an essential reading for those who have wondered or have been told it's time for a change. In times where understanding what your consumer wants is just as important as understanding your product, knowing the best assets within your marketing portfolio can prove invaluable. Do you believe that structural packaging is underutilized as a tool to build distinctive brand assets through package shape?
Possibly, but the challenge I think with structural packaging is how does it work in an e-commerce space? Structural shape can stand out perhaps on shelf when you've got a physical product in front of you. I think designers really need to think about how is this going to play in a thumbnail in an e-commerce space, because that's where a lot of the future is in terms of branding. We'll always have stores, and I'm not downplaying that, but I think marketers are going to be looking for assets that will work in both kinds of environments. If you're proposing something that might be really sexy on shelf, but it's going to cost a lot of money and not work online, that might be a really hard challenge for the company or the brand to invest in.
Very interesting, because when we work with 3D, you can affect pack shape with a distinctive silhouette, and that will work very well in a thumbnail. But there are certain aspects of structure that won't translate very well to an e-commerce environment.
So it can work, but you just need to think about that environment as well as the physical shelf environment, and think of it within the limitations of what retailers will allow as well. Because even if you go, oh, but if we do this fancy spin around image, people will see it. A, recognize that most shoppers won't do that. And B, recognize that sometimes retailers don't want that added complexity because they just want a simple, easy to navigate shop.
How can we select our brand assets? Why do you say that we should think menu rather than meal?
This comes to the idea of a lot of the times when people talk about assets, they consider them one at a time. So they'll go, our tagline, our color, our face of our brand. Without stepping back and going, well, how do these work all together? And so when you're thinking of a meal, if I'm thinking of dinner tonight, I'm just thinking of dinner tonight. But if I was opening up a restaurant tonight, I wouldn't just think about one meal. I'd think about a menu and how it all fits together. Whatever taste someone comes in with, I've got something that will suit them. So I'd like us to think of our distinctive assets in the same way. We have lots of different branding environments. We just talked about two examples there, a sales environment that's in the physical store and a sales environment that's online. So I want to have assets that will allow me to brand as best I can in each of those environments. And sometimes it will be the same asset, sometimes it will be totally different assets. And so having a distinctive asset palette, a set of assets that don't overlap with each other, so you're not duplicating resources by trying to build two assets that do the same thing, but fit together so that you don't have any gaps, so you don't have any branding environments where you can't utilize distinctive assets as branding devices. That also means designers working with creative agencies in advertising, because these are all different branding environments. And there's some assets that are solely in advertising, but maybe could be utilized on pack, and packaging assets that are used in advertising. Working together to think about all of the different sorts of environments where the asset might be used and how it works, I think benefits the brand as a whole.
Uniqueness and fame. I am not talking about celebrities. Tell me about how we can measure distinctive brand assets.
Well, I'll start with uniqueness. So if I show you the color blue and I ask you what banks are associated with that, then whatever our target brand is, its share of all of the banks that are linked to the color blue, that's its uniqueness. And then fame is how widespread is that knowledge? So what proportion of category buyers linked our target bank with the color blue? So that's how well known the asset is, because for an asset to work, it needs to be well known, so thought of by many people, but the only brand thought of, so unique, when the asset is present, but the brand is not.
Can smaller emerging brands take advantage of distinctive brand assets to gain an edge over bigger established brands?
Absolutely. And in fact, it's a bit of a myth out there that only big brands have strong distinctive assets. I use a lot of big brands in my examples because I do presentations around the world. And if I use like a local brand, everyone would go, "What's that? Never heard of it." And I do talk about this in the book. While big brands have some advantages, they usually have bigger budgets. They also have some disadvantages, like lots of people with their finger in the pie, turnover of staff, meaning new people coming in and wanting to change everything, that can basically squander any financial advantage they have. And you can see small brands that are more disciplined, only build up one or two assets, but do it consistently over a long period of time, can actually end up with stronger assets than a big brand where everything's all fragmented and lots of things are started, but nothing's committed to for the long term. Now, I will say for a small brand, particularly a new brand, you do have a ceiling, obviously, of your prompted brand awareness. Because if people don't have the brand in their brains, you can't build distinctive assets to it. So you do need to make sure that you are known as a member of the category. And I do deliberately use prompted brand awareness as the measure there, because that is the best measure of, do people have you in their brains? Are you a member of the category? On your path to doing that, I'm very much a believer in start as you mean to go on. So even if you're launching a new brand, you should survey the competitive environment, see what assets people have developed, and counter-program to that. Do pick assets that you can own so you don't have to change your distinctive assets should the new launch be successful. You should start building one or two assets, doesn't have to be like 20, right from the start, and keep, as you expand your budget, advertising in more mediums, being sold in more places, you may think about adding to your distinctive asset palette to help you in those environments. But building assets is the same whether you're big or small. We recommend that any brand only build one or two assets at a time, because trying to build too many means you don't build any.
Very interesting. The Ehrenberg-Bass Institute has coined the term evidence-based marketing. Is it possible to talk about evidence-based design, or is science the enemy of creative magic?
I disagree, because look at something like building bridges and architecture. That's evidence-based design. When you build a bridge, it's not like anything goes. You've got gravity. You've got materials science that tells you about what weight different materials can take and what you need to do structurally to make sure that the bridge won't collapse. We have so many different bridges, some really beautiful ones all around the world that all perform the function, hopefully, that they're supposed to do. I don't see why that's different from any other form of design. So science provides the parameters that allow then designers to be creative, but together with the science have a greater chance of overall success. So to me, I think both go hand in hand. I'm amazed by the creativity some people have. That is not my strong point. I'm a scientist, but I'd like to think that the work helps inform creative.
I completely agree. I think that your book, it's like a torch that illuminates our creative endeavors, because it's great to have some science like an ingredient, especially in package design. These kind of insights are great to inform our creativity.
Yeah, thank you. And that's part of the reason why I do these podcasts with designers such as yourself, is because I realize that a lot of the stuff I do is promoted in the field of marketing and might not reach as many designers as I would like. And I just think it's just really important that marketing and design works hand in hand.
What are the few things that you think designers need to know right now and don't know? And what's a piece of advice that would help designers improve their projects?
I do want designers to understand that not all research is the enemy. There is some research that can help and inform. There is a lot of bad research out there that tries to constrain creative. It happens in impact design. So I do totally understand the frustration that designers must have when someone talks about, well, we've got to go out and test this now, knowing that some of the testing techniques are not actually particularly helpful in terms of the questions they ask and how they go about doing it. I would encourage designers to ask questions about things like the environment it's going in. Ask the questions that I've asked about, do you want this to be a branding device or a messaging device? And be really clear on that, because that gives you freedom. It seems really efficient to say this is both a branding device and a messaging device, but it just doesn't work in practice. So any efficiency gains is lost in effectiveness.
And what would be your top tips for making sure your brand assets are truly distinctive?
Measurement. Don't trust your gut instinct. It's designed to lead you astray, but by virtue of what you pay attention to, even your own brand. We actually do have another project in place that's looking at how accurate marketers are at being able to detect their distinctive assets and how strong they are. I think for too long, when it comes to things like design and distinctive assets, we have opinion-based arguments rather than evidence-based discussions. So when in doubt, get objective measurement, and then you've got facts to inform the conversation on what to keep, what to build, what to abandon.
It's always quantitative research.
I have a great respect for qualitative research, but you don't need it in this forum. And indeed, what happens when you do qualitative research with distinctive assets is people channel their inner designer and they start to give you design tips when they're not designers, they're consumers. Don't do focus groups. Focus groups are the worst things to do. That's when you get comments and individual comments get blown out. Similarly with social media monitoring, unrepresentative comments get blown out of proportion and people feel the need to act upon them because that's the information they're getting. So I'm not a big fan of qualitative research for packaging design research. I don't know what purpose it serves. I think designers are the expert in creative, and then you want a general informed opinion, not over-involved opinion of a select few. So yeah, I would go quantitative research.
Do you think that we will see new brands assets in the future? How will brands behave in virtual, mixed or augmented shopping environments?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. I always joke because they used to talk about movies having smell-o-vision. We'd go to the movies and the smells would come off and you would have that sensory experience. So I get clients who want to test aromas and I'm like, yeah, sorry, we don't have smell-o-vision yet. I'm curious to know what virtual reality was all the rage about 5 years ago, and it just seems to have abated somewhat. So I'm not sure how the developments are there, but I know there were some really fascinating developments in haptics and incorporating touch. Funnily enough, through the porn industry is where this was happening, but, you know, it will bleed out into more mainstream other forms of communications as well. And so when we have that, then yes, touch will come into play, other senses might come into play, but I think for a long time we're going to be relying on our eyes and our ears. And I still think there's a lot we can do there and a lot that's underutilized. I don't think it's a stale stomping ground with just the 7 forms of eyes and ears assets that we have right now. I think there's still a lot we can learn about how to develop assets and how to execute assets to really utilize those. So even if the technology doesn't come quick for the other senses, I still think there's a lot of advancements we can make with the eyes and ears that we're using now.
What about your research is most important to you? What impact would you like your work to have?
So the most important thing for me with research and why I do it is I love learning new stuff. I'm selfish in some ways. The most important part of my research is I'm constantly challenging, constantly learning, constantly exploring new things. I'm always grateful when anyone else, you know, takes the time to also listen to it as well and act upon it. My primary motivation is to satisfy my own curiosity, first of all, then share that with like-minded individuals who might also have been asking the same sort of questions. It's constantly challenging my own view of the world. Because I think as a researcher, you get stale when you start to think you know it all. And so learning new stuff is part of the fun that I get paid to be a researcher and learn new stuff. That's fun.
Yeah. Please tell me something about brand assets that's true that almost nobody agrees with you.
One thing that's getting a lot of attention that I think is a distraction is this idea that some assets are better than others, that you can succeed through an asset type, that you should say, have a character that will improve your advertising. That's wrong. All assets can be strong. It's about, first of all, selecting right, but then also executing well as well. So I think sometimes people assume if I do an analysis of past packs and work out what works, that will inform the future, and they neglect. There's a whole heap of things that are wrong with the approach, but they also miss the point is that our past was not informed by evidence. And so relying on that as best practice basically constrains us to things that worked in the absence of any form of evidence or strategy. I'd like people to think that's true about distinctive assets is all asset types can be strong in that they can get a close to 100% fame, 100% uniqueness. I would like people to realize that with all asset types, any of them can be strong. You just have to select something that, you know, basically isn't already compromised because of meaning or competitors. And then you have to really execute it well so that it's prominent, widespread, and linked very closely to the brand name. And if you do that, you can build an asset of any type.
Shani, what's your next adventure?
Oh, when you say next adventure, I think travel. And I go, I don't know, because I can't leave the country yet. So, yeah, that's what I'm thinking of my next adventure. My next adventure research-wise is just finishing now How Brands Grow Part 2. We've just done revisions on that because it's 5 years since it was first launched. And it was also the first book I wrote. So, you know, I went back and did a bit of refreshing, updating, actually wrote, there's a new chapter in there on B2B marketing to really consolidate that area, totally rewritten chapters on physical availability because we've advanced so much in our knowledge there from the initial edition. Yeah, then it's on to the next book, which I don't want to talk too much about because I actually have to sit down and write it.
I hope that when you updated your brand Grow 2, you were respectful with the brand distinctive assets of that book.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's quite funny because when Byron showed me the cover of How Brands Grow that was red, I just sort of looked at him and went, since when has red been our color? Him and the commercial manager went, well, because we wanted to stand out on shelf. And I just looked at them and said, have I taught you nothing? So, of course, when my book came out, it was no question what colour it would be. And then the cover of Distinctive Assets, that was so easy. I just went, we have a character with a face on it. I'm putting the owl on the cover and it's going to be blue. So, yeah, I'd like to practice what I preach.
Perfect.
yeah.
Well, Shani, thank you for your curiosity, for your consistency, your uniqueness and your salience. Your insights complement the inherent creativity of design with the rigor of science and make our discipline increasingly compelling. So, muchas gracias.
De nada.
I hope you have enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. You can check the episode notes for all the relevant links. I also invite you to follow me on Instagram and on my website, branderman.design. Follow the podcast in your favorite app so you don't miss the next episode of Branderman. the podcast where we try to uncover how to make a positive impact on consumers, the market, and society through package design.